Thank you. Let me just say, as a Southern Seminary geek of long standing, it is an absolute thrill to be delivering the Norton Lectures. I have to say, I never thought that this would happen. 20 years ago, I was literally in the basement of the man who just spoke, Dr. Moeller, working in his basement back before it was completely finished. It was more like the cabinet war rooms back then. And many of you know, there was a battle engaged. And to be standing here today with you is a high honor and privilege. And thank you so much for being here today. Our goal in these Norton Lectures, I'll be giving one today and then two tomorrow, and there is a bit of an arc, is to talk a little bit about the intersection of current developments in continental philosophy and European philosophy as it intersects with interest in Christianity. And the title for these lectures is, If You Can't Beat Them, Paraphrase Them. Contemporary Theology Imitates Christian Theology. Now, this series is born out of many years teaching undergraduate students philosophy. And to give a reference from The Who, one of my favorite bands, I want to affirm to you that the kids are all right, but the kids are reading Nietzsche. And so I've said this elsewhere, but I do think that familiarity with current trends in philosophy is the new pre-evangelism, because as I move now in New York City and I meet not only students at the amazing students at the King's College, but we have an intellectually awake generation, and the internet has them reading widely, if not deeply, in many things. And so we need to take a page out of the book of our heroes, chief amongst them being, I just saw the Towers magazine, C.S. Lewis. We have to remember that when C.S. Lewis originally published his volume on miracles, it came under criticism from Wittgenstein, arguably Wittgenstein's greatest student, Elizabeth Anscombe, who asked him to address certain issues, and he did. He listened to the philosophers of his day, and the result was a better work that came. We could do, so I guess what I'm trying to say throughout these lectures is, if it's good enough for C.S. Lewis, it's good enough for you. So we want to try to learn from the current field, and I think we might be surprised at what we find. I want to use as a biblical text for these three talks, and I'll be revisiting it as we go along, that when Paul stood on the Areopagus at Mars Hill addressing the philosophers of his day, the Epicurean and the Stoic philosophers, there's a line here that I don't think gets talked about enough, and I would like to revisit it, and I think we need to rigorously go back and ask what it means when Paul says in Acts 17:27, yet actually he is not far from any of you. He is not far from any of you. And what I think we're seeing right now in the field of philosophy is a great renewal of interest in spirituality, in asceticism, in, of all things, monasticism. This is what we're going to be talking about. And also in explicitly Christian theological themes. Now, I don't know how many of you are aficionados of TED Talks, but one of the more interesting ones that I saw in the last couple of years was from Alain de Botton, the British philosopher, who is admittedly a secularist and an atheist. And this TED Talk became fodder for what eventually became a book that he produced called Religion for Atheists. And here's what he said in this TED Talk. He said, you know, we have to stop this whole business of mocking religion and pretending as though believers are stupid and that Christians are idiots, because A, it's not true, and B, we atheists have a lot to learn. And for example, one of the things that we think is that if we just make a powerful rational argument, people will change their minds and just sail along with the course of reason. But people forget things. And one of the genius things that the church has that we don't have is they have a liturgy. They sing the same songs over and over again. They say the creed every Sunday. They preach, they teach, they reinforce these things over and over time. So in his book, Religion for Atheists, he said, I realized that I did not have to give up on the music, the buildings, the artworks, the prayers, the rituals, the feasts and the shrines and pilgrimages and communal meals. Let's just rip them off and do what they're doing. Now, part of what I want to say in a preliminary way as an encouragement to you in this environment as you're listening to these lectures is I want to encourage you as seminarians to be bold in what you are doing. Let your freak flag fly for Jesus, because people out there are taking note and they're actually trying to imitate us. So Alain de Botton with a number of other people have started a secularist church in Great Britain called the School of Life. You can go on a Sunday morning. You can sing secularist hymns. I'm not making this up. You take your place. There's a desk. You get sermons on vertical themes, things that are supposed to lift the spirit upward. You hear talks on design and philosophy and art and all of the rest. So we're at a very different stage than where we were even maybe 5 years ago, in which I think there was a very boring and banal debate between the so-called new atheists and the traditional theists, and that's what everybody was talking about. But when you have both a figure like Peter Sloterdijk, the great German philosopher who I'll be talking about tomorrow, you have both him and David Bentley Hart, arguably one of the preeminent writing theologians of our time, both saying the Dawkins and the Daniel Dennett's and the A.C. Grayling's and the late Christopher Hitchens of this world are stupid, their arguments are idiotic, and we ought to do away with engagement of them once and for all. We're in a different kind of day now, and I think that they're right. The real game nowadays is between people who want to try to borrow and live as magpies living off of the tradition of Christianity without accepting its core doctrinal conclusions and beliefs. So if I could put it this way in the language of popular culture, for many contemporary theorists of our time, Christianity is the long-lost girlfriend that they just cannot get over. So even though they may have moved on, they're still thinking about her all the time and still wanting to repristinate that relationship over and over again, even though, as B.B. King would sing, the thrill is gone. And so the three figures that I would like to talk about during the course of these lectures are, first today, the apoplectic Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about Peter Sloterdijk, and who's German, and a French philosopher named Quentin Meillassou. And I think we'll be surprised at how much of their current work is informed by explicitly Christian theological themes. And this is not to mention other people that we could talk about, like Alain Badiou and Giorgio Agamben and Gilles Deleuze as well. We wouldn't have to just have these three. What all of these guys are doing, when you watch them write, it's actually quite astonishing, is to realize how into our tradition they actually are in certain circumstances. And so it's kind of like when you turn on the radio and you hear John Mayer playing, and you're like, man, that just sounds like Stevie Ray Vaughan. It's like we've all heard this before in an earlier phase, and it was better the first time around. So I'm just, oddly, I'm trying to encourage you as seminarians to really sink your roots down deep in the tradition, because there are other people out there that care enough about it to try to copy it. Now, in this lecture, I want to take up the case of Slavoj Žižek, who is often referred to as the world's leading Christian atheist. Now, if ever there was an oxymoron, that was one, but for some reason, it seems to stick in the case of Žižek. And this is despite the fact that I believe deeply, it's one of my core convictions, and this applies to everything, not just to that descriptor of Christian atheist, that Christian is the greatest of all possible nouns and the lamest of all possible adjectives. Think about that just for a second. and we continue. So who is Slavoj Žižek? He's a thinker who fraternizes with a lot of theologians, like John Milbank and Creston Davis. He knows his Bible stories better than many evangelicals do. And yet, in his recent film that just came out last week, at the penultimate scene of the film, he says things like this. "The message of Christ is that I'm dying, but my death is itself good news. The cry of dereliction from the cross means that you are alone, left to your freedom. So be in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, which is simply the community of believers. It's wrong to think that the second coming of Christ will be a return as a figure somehow. Christ is already here when believers form an emancipatory collective. This is why I claim that the only way really to be an atheist is to go through Christianity. Christianity is much more atheist than the usual atheism, which claims that there is no God and so on, but nonetheless retains a certain trust in the big other. The big other can be naturalism, natural necessity, Darwinian evolutionary theory, or whatever." Now, before you just kind of dismiss all that kind of thing as crazy-making, I find it interesting to note that a very similar argument was made recently by David Bentley Hart in First Things about the way in which the essay was called No Enduring City. And David Bentley Hart was saying, there is something about the way Christianity has unfolded throughout history in its socio-political expression that has set the stage quite nicely for atheism. So who can blame Žižek for these kinds of comments? Well, I judge him, but we'll get to that later. So who is Žižek? He is a theorist who is, by any reasonable estimate, the most well-known public philosopher of our time. Pick up this week's copy of New York Magazine, and there's a major feature story on Žižek. He's churned out over 50 very serious academic volumes over the past three decades, including his most recent work, which is a 1,200-page magnum opus, his homage to Hegel, Marx, and Lacan, entitled Less Than Nothing: Hegel and the Shadow of Dialectical Materialism. He's a former presidential candidate in Slovenia. He is the international director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Humanities and is a professor of philosophy and psychoanalysis at the European Graduate School. Many of you will have seen him on the news 2 years ago during Occupy Wall Street, and for a couple of days, he was the high priest of Occupy Wall Street until he started critiquing Occupy Wall Street and compared them to the Tea Party, at which point they started throwing eggs and things at him. Žižek is a court jester of the coming apocalypse. That is how I would describe him, the court jester of the coming apocalypse, but somehow the joke always seems to be on us. Now, on Friday night this past week, I went to see the premiere of Žižek's new film, and it's on Ideology, and he was there with director Sophie Fiennes, and there was a Q&A. And what he wants to show in exposing Ideology is to show that society is actually not formed by deliberate principles of freedom or equality, but it's the our values are the expressions of repressed desires, whether that be shame, guilt, or sexual insecurity. And while we're convinced that the universe is really interpretable, that it's rational, that it will all make sense in the end, what Žižek says is that we're actually just suffering from involuntary psychic fantasies. That's the way the New York Magazine reporter put it. So what Žižek's trying to do is expose rigorously Ideology through this quasi-Marxist Lacanian lens. And we don't have time to go into both of those theorists, but let's just say Lacan has his own trinity that he supplements for the Godhead, the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real. And what happens for Žižek in this trinity of the imaginary, symbolic, and the real is that The imaginary stage, just a quick summary of this, the imaginary stage is the stage that Lacan noticed in a famous paper that he read, that a child in the 6th month to the 18th month begins to be able to look into the mirror and be able to realize that they have control over their movements. And this gives them the feeling of control, that they have control over their own body. It's a major discovery. But what winds up happening is alienation, because as time goes on, you really realize that you don't have control. So you begin to struggle for the next thing, which is the symbolic order, which is language, which is the world of law and words. But there's a cut between the imaginary phase, who we really are, and our ability to express ourselves through law and in words. So there's a cut between these two. So we reach out for what Lacan and Zizek call the big other, some totalizing truth to try to explain everything to us. But of course, the big other isn't there. It's what he calls the desert of the real. And so what is ideology for Zizek? He says that for people, and that's all of us, captive to ideology, in our activity, we know that deep down, what we are doing is an illusion, but we keep on doing it anyway. Even though there's this kind of deep, did you see Louis C.K.? On Conan, when he was talking about cell phones, the forever empty, that's the real for Zizek, okay? The real is that forever empty. When you're away from your technology for long enough, you realize there's this void, there is this deep abyss, which we all descend into. So, Zizek is very good at elucidating all kinds of ideologies, and that there's this void, and we are so captive to any kind of ideology that comes on. Now, one that he will not talk about, especially in urbane places like the IFC Film Theater in New York, but I'll go ahead and use it here. A perfect example of ideology is the 2008 Obama presidential campaign, because hope and change, and yes, we can, it is a perfect example of ideology, because it's an empty receptacle into which everybody can place all of their hopes and dreams. But what happens is, once you place all of your dreams into that empty receptacle, you realize it's not going to give anything back to you. You're going to get stuck on the website and get the spinning beach ball of death. That's what Zizek's going for, and he just runs the table on this. Now, there's a wrinkle here. Now, how does this all relate to Zizek's interest in Christianity? Let's bring it back here. Zizek, I wouldn't say he's bothered by it. He's actually delighted in this central fact, is that in this environment of ideology, the only people that really seem to be enjoying themselves in this desert of the real are Orthodox Christians. They seem to be just doing fine, you know, sailing right along. And one of Zizek's favorite authors is G.K. Chesterton. And one of his favorite books by G.K. Chesterton, although there are many, and talks about them all throughout his corpus of writings, is Orthodoxy. And so, for example, what he says when he's talking about Chesterton is how Chesterton talks about, have you read Orthodoxy? If you don't, I judge you. You should definitely read that, because he talks about the daring romance of Orthodoxy, right? At the beginning of Orthodoxy. And how thrilling it is to actually go back to the romance of Orthodoxy. So listen to what Zizek says about Chesterton with respect to one of the key cultural debates of our time. Quote, "The subversive sting of Chesterton's work is contained in the endless variation of one and the same matrix of the Hegelian paradoxical self-negating reversal." Pay no attention to that. Here's the real quote. So, for example, what if in our postmodern world of ordained transgression, in which the marital commitment is perceived to be ridiculously out of date, those who cling to it are the true cultural subversives? What if today heterosexual straight marriage is the most dark and daring of all transgressions. So all of a sudden now, orthodoxy is this thing that seems to kind of oddly stand outside of the zeitgeist and the ideology of the age, and we're getting away with it. And Zizek, I think, delights a little bit in this these kinds of episodes. And he finds a lot to talk about and to read specifically when it comes to this debate between totalitarian atheism and Christianity. And listen to what he says here, continuing on his discussion of orthodoxy. In the very last pages of Orthodoxy, Chesterton deploys the fundamental Hegelian paradox of the pseudo-revolutionary critics of religion. So these are the Dennets, these are the Graylings, these are the Dawkins of the world. They start by denouncing religion as the force of oppression that threatens human freedom. In fighting religion, however, they are compelled to forsake freedom itself, thus sacrificing precisely that which they wanted to defend. The ultimate victim of the atheist theoretical and practical rejection of religion is not religion, which unperturbed continues its life, but freedom itself, allegedly threatened by it. The atheist radical universe, deprived of religious reference, is the gray universe of egalitarian terror and tyranny, unquote. Okay, so this is Zizek talking about these things in his book, The Puppet and the Dwarf. Later on, a couple of pages later, he says, why is it that it's only the Christian authors that can come up with magnificent science fiction and fantasy novels? Okay? Why is it only now he doesn't talk about Orson Scott Card, but maybe he ought to, but the Tolkiens and the Lewises, why is it? He said that only Christians can truly appreciate a pagan universe, okay? Because they can imagine what it would be like to live in a pagan universe that is this kind of magical world in which kind of the modernistic frame is temporarily suspended. So he says only Tolkien can write The Lord of the Rings. And actually, it's in keeping with something that C.S. Lewis himself said in an interview with Time magazine in 1955, in which he said, the Christian has far more in common with the pagan mind than it does the modern mind. Well, what Zizek is saying is that the modern mind has run its course. It's come to a zero point, and we have nowhere to go at this point. We are at an apocalyptic point. It's so bad, Zizek says. This is one of his favorite examples. It's so bad that in Hollywood film after Hollywood film, we can imagine the total annihilation of the planet Earth. In film after film, we can imagine the entire human race ceasing to be, but we can't think of what it would look like to live outside of our current mode of cultural capitalism. So he's like, where are we supposed to go after that? We're at a zero point. But here's the Chestertons and the Tolkiens and the Lewises and the Kierkegaards of this world that seem to be floating, you know, along and doing just fine and living in community. And so Zizek is very interested. He's written several books and co-authored several books now on the Apostle Paul and the New Testament. And he's like, why are we keeping at arm's length these Christians? If I were a Marxist, I see St. Paul and his, you know, ecclesiology. This is a kind of a made-to-order Marxist, collective type situation that's kind of like fist in the, you know, face of the empire. Well, it's not that, but he keeps looking for those kinds of examples and raiding the Christian texts this kind of thing. And so he sees this emancipatory nature of Christianity, which he himself does not buy in terms of a transcendent explanation of things. He's an atheist. So in an interview he just gave a couple of weeks ago this fall with a religious journal at Villanova, listen to this interchange. Do you believe in God? No, I am a complete atheist. Your book, The Puppet and the Dwarf, though, deals with St. Paul. In fact, it celebrates St. Paul's Christianity in contrast to other forms of spirituality, Gnosticism, New Age spiritualities. So why would an atheist defend Christianity? Zizek. What I like is to see the emancipatory potential of institutionalized Christianity. Of course, I don't mean state religion. I mean the moment of St. Paul. I find a couple of good things in it. The idea of the gospel or good news was a totally different logic of emancipation, of justice, of freedom. For example, with the pagan attitude, injustice means a disturbance of the natural order. In ancient Hinduism, or even with Plato, justice was defined in what we would call almost fascistic terms, each in his or her own place in a just order. Man is the benevolent father of the family, women doing their job taking care of the family, the worker doing his work, and so on. But the message of the gospel sends is precisely the kind of radical abandonment of this idea of some kind of natural balance. The idea of the gospels and the part of sin is that freedom is zero. We begin at the zero point, which is at least originally the point of radical equality. Look at what St. Paul is writing and the metaphors he uses. It's messianic, the end of time. Differences are suspended. Galatians 3:28. It's a totally different world whose formal structure is that of revolution. Even in ancient Greece, you won't find that. This idea that the world can be turned on its head, that we're not irreducibly bound by the chains of our past. So here's Zizek, who writes about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the ecological disasters and the economic disasters of our time. We're at the zero point. We're at the end of history. And the only people that really seem to have any ideas about how to move us off dead center, ironically, are the Christians. Now, unfortunately for Zizek, this is not really good news, because the one thing that he cannot move himself to believe is that something other than kind of an emancipatory freedom is being enunciated from the cross. He explicitly renounces the one thing that you must believe in order to be saved, which is a vicarious, substitutionary nature of the atonement on the cross. What he does not see, which I keep hoping that someday he will see, I would love to meet Zizek and talk to him about this, is how Christ on the cross repairs that cut that he talks about, that Lacan talks about, between the imaginary and the symbolic order. It's precisely the kind of solution that he's looking for, where God comes down and repairs that breach. But just like one of Lacan's favorite stories, Poe's Purloined Letter. For Zizek, even though he keeps returning to Christianity over and over again, the gospel, the real gospel, is like Edgar Allan Poe's The Purloined Letter. It is the thing that would tell the truth that is hidden in plain sight, and he just can't seem to square with it. But here's the truth of the matter. I think that Zizek knows that there is some kind of telos, even though he's a Hegelian, to be found in Christian theology, because his patron saint, Jacques Lacan, in a press conference in 1974, was being asked by reporters about the death of religion. And we keep hearing in every generation, since the 19th century, we were just talking about this at lunch with Dr. Moeller, about the death of religion, the obsolescence of religion. So they're talking to Lacan about how psychoanalysis going to finally once and for all do away with the religious impulse? Listen to this exchange. Here's one of the journalists. You said if religion triumphs, it will be because psychoanalysis will have failed. How do you account for the triumph of psychoanalysis over religion? Lacan, psychoanalysis will not triumph over religion. Religion is indistinguishable. Psychoanalysis will never triumph over it. It will either survive or not survive. Why use this expression, the triumph of religion over psychoanalysis? Do you think that religion will triumph? Lacan, yes. It will triumph over psychoanalysis and over many other things too. We can't even begin to imagine how powerful religion is. I mentioned the real a moment ago. In this regard, religion is going to have many more grounds for soothing people's souls, as we say, because science will hardly be able to ground the real from its perspective, since science, as I just said, is about novelty, and it's going to introduce tons and tons of absolutely earth-shattering things into people's lives. That's the forecast of our technological age and the iPhone and all the rest. And religion, especially the true one, possesses resources for grounding things that we haven't even begun to suspect. And he goes on and on and on. Lacan then gets pushback on this. They're freaking out that he's saying religion's going to triumph over science and psychoanalysis. And here's how he concludes. There is only one true religion, and it is Christianity. And the Roman expression is the true one. Sorry, it's in the text. Just try putting all the religions into one bag and then make, for example, what is called a history of religions. It's truly horrific. There is only one true religion, and that religion is Christianity. The only thing is to know whether this truth will hold on, whether it will be able to end up to actually drown us in all of the meanings it spews forth. The only thing that we can do is to look at all the resources it has at its disposal. It will interpret the book of Revelation for people in our time. A lot of people have been taking stabs at it. It will unearth correlations between everything. This is Christianity's function, in fact. I think it's helpful for us to look at a figure like Slavoj Žižek as we are doing evangelism, because he's forcing upon our society a radical choice. Either you accept a full-throated orthodoxy like a Chesterton or like a Lewis, and you enjoy the world, or you accept his position, which is that we are alone and that there is nothing out there for us except the void. There is nothing to believe. There is no big other. When we consider someone like Žižek, we wonder whether or not it would be possible for him or anyone like him to take that extra step and to see the joie de vivre, the overcoming of this barrier to jouissance that Žižek is always talking about, to true enjoyment out of life, and to believe that actually the truly monstrous thought, I mean, the end of the world is not the most monstrous thought for an atheist like Žižek. The most monstrous thought of all would be if Christ is really risen from the dead and that he's on the loose. The hound of heaven is on the loose. That he's actually sitting at the right hand of God the Father, from whence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. That there is a vicarious atonement. That there is a bodily resurrection. But the only way, and here's where I want to park the bus today, the only way someone like Žižek would know that is if once and for all the Christian community gives up on this business of trying to portray a kind of religion or a kind of Christianity to the world. That the scripture is kind of true, but we have all these like reservations about whether or not the Bible is truly the word of God. Or, you know, Christ kind of died for our sins, but it seems, you know, is this cosmic child abuse when we talk about the atonement. The only way you could reach someone like Žižek is if you really did have that pure expression of the romance of orthodoxy. And that's what we have to offer him. So for this lecture, I end where I began. When you're in your Greek classes and in your Hebrew classes and in your systematic theology classes and in church history, sink your roots down deep, because that is the only message which has the engine under the hood to reach people in our time. And let me close with this. I don't know how many of you saw the documentary on Woody Allen that came out last year, but there's a great fly in the ointment in that film, Father Robert Lauder, who is a priest, and he's written several things on Woody Allen, and he says this at the end. I've referred to in the past to Woody Allen as Albert Camus, the comedian. Camus said, "I don't want to die. I don't want anyone I love to die. But I'm going to die, and everyone I love is going to die, and that makes life absurd." And Woody Allen believes that. But he's able somehow to weave in humor, just like Zizek. He's able to weave in humor. You watch any of Zizek's lectures or his films, the parts that you can actually watch, and they are hilarious. There's humor in there. But here's what Lauder says. I think Woody is able to make it a bit more palatable, but I'm going to ask him, if life really is absurd and horrible, if it really is a desert of the real, to use Zizek's line, and brutal, my question is, why are we still laughing? Thank you so much, and it was great to be here.